Assalamu alaikum. Good morning to everybody. I want to start by saying that I never thought I'd actually share this story in front of a group of people, but it occurred to me that our community has been suffering from a lot of different things, and one of the ways that we can heal our community is through sharing our stories. That's how we can begin to heal all manners of issues in our community. So I thought by modeling this, it would be hopefully inspiring to others to share theirs as well, because we need to share our stories more often so that we can be connected as a people. I've been a Muslim for more than 20 years, so I can't condense that all down in 10 minutes, but I am going to share with you some of my experiences. I want to first tell you that as a convert, I wasn't co-opted into Islam through a relationship. I became a Muslim through my study of Islam. It was finding peace within the theology of Islam that brought me to Islam. Despite that, the politics of my skin, I have been placed on an island of nowhere is what I call it. What I quickly discovered is that my skin spoke for me before I spoke. And to different people, this meant different things. So for some people, it meant commodification. For example, a white person became Muslim, so we've arrived, or we have confirmation that Islam is for real because a white person became a Muslim. Or for some people, it was like, all white people are evil, and so this is our opportunity to sort of let out all our feelings about that, because now we have access to somebody who we can share those feelings with. And then some others, it was about cultural stories of their own about the importance of the color of one's skin, whether they're light or dark. And so we become, you know, baby making machines for transcending that, you know, issue of lightness, so we can make people's babies lighter. And, you know, so there are a lot of issues that came up, and that momentary peace that I felt when I converted was gone pretty instantaneously by all the projected issues that were coming out of the community. But as a result of that, what happens is, as you know, we hear all the time about how our veils kind of sometimes speak for us and make us sort of invisible to our characters, our values, our skills, what we bring to the table. But so for the white convert, so does their skin. We kind of become white, and that's all people see until they get to know us. When people get to know me, they tend to think that I identify with the other, but before that, it's kind of, you're white. And the same is pretty much true for my male counterparts, from what I've observed. The only difference is they have one distinct advantage. They're white and male, and for some reason, that puts them in a better place where no matter what their skill set is, it's somehow inflated. They could be the last person graduating in their class, but because of their whiteness, they're seen as having more skills than other people who actually have better skill sets, who may not be white. Where did this take me? Well, back in 1992, when I took my shahada, I was still a teenager. And so this impacted me pretty heavily as a teenager, because as we know, teenage brains are not fully developed. And although I was a teen, I was bombarded with the ignorant projections of the dominant culture. So all of a sudden, I found myself in this space where I had a duality of both of dealing with what was going on in the dominant culture and within our community. So some of the things that I experienced from the dominant culture were, for example, about 3 months into my conversion, I started wearing hijab. And for the first 2 weeks, I was like, oh Allah, you really have given me a test here, because the things that occurred were just fantastical. I mean, people were literally crossing the street to say things to me about my hijab. So, you know, some people would be driving by and call me a sand nigger. Some people would come up to me and say, nice headgear. Eventually, one day, some teenage boys were driving by as I was walking to the library, and they were like, hey, angel of death. And I had reached my point of what I could tolerate with all this name calling, because, you know, names can hurt, and eventually they can bother you. So I thought about what the Prophet said about what we can do in terms of our, you know, revenge. We can't do anything that's worse, but we can, you know, do something that, as long as it's not worse. And so I kind of gave them a bird, you know. And that was, you know, I regretted that later. I felt kind of badly about it. But, you know, at the time I was kind of at my limit and I needed to like express myself. And then, you know, continued on. It was, you know, it was a real change because when you're used to being a part of the dominant culture and you're not questioned about what you do, and then you become an other and you start to realize that other people have another experience, and that experience is constantly being scrutinized and questioned about every decision, everything you do. Let me just say, you know, as a testament to how difficult this experience was for me, I had a situation in one of my Arabic classes where I there was a Jewish girl in my class, and it was a time when I was trying to go through putting on my veil. And so I would wear it for a couple days a week, and then I wouldn't wear it for a couple days because I was trying to figure out how to do this. It was really hard to make that transition when you get so much validation in society from, you know, being seen as a woman. It was hard to make that transition into hijab. So this Jewish girl in my class outed me one day in front of everyone and says, "So are you gonna do this thing or not?" Right? And it was so much pressure to have, you know, I'm still a teenager, remember, and I had my insides basically exposed for the world to see, you know, all my insecurities, all that stuff. And what was interesting about that is not really that event itself, but what happened after that. So, and this is what, this was my entree into community life. So my professor, who was at the time from Saudi Arabia, he called another sister in the community, who then called me to find out if I was okay. He didn't want to say anything to me because he was navigating his own cultural norms and values, but still wanted to make sure I was okay. So he called this sister, who later became my roommate and lifelong friend, to see if I was okay. And this started a positive experience with the community. Whereas he then sort of took me in as family in a way to give me a sense of tribe because I was out there alone. But at the same time, I learned a lot about what was not being said. And so I would go to visit his house with his family. I was enjoying it. I was getting to learn about all things Arab. And Arab hospitality is unmatched. We all know that. So it was an interesting experience, and one day, as I was getting ready to leave, he said, "Heather, wait a minute, I gotta tell you something. You are sitting here with these women, enjoying yourself, and as soon as you leave the room, they are talking about you just nonstop." He said they get on the phone, they talk about what you didn't know, what violations of what cultural norms you committed, all these different things about, you know, I should be doing this and I should be doing that. Of course, I was completely unaware. I mean, let's face it, when we're interacting interculturally, most of the time we make mistakes because we're just unaware. We're unaware of what the norms are of the other people. And it's not usually because we don't like people, it's because we just don't know, we're just unaware. So that was a real interesting experience to know that what was on the surface of what I was experiencing, there was a whole other world underneath that I didn't know about. I want to mention what was going on with the dominant culture at that time as well. So we have this duality between, as I said before, between the dominant culture and our community. What was going on in the dominant culture at the time is we were going to war with Iraq, and Muslims were under attack way before 9/11. We were having our cars searched by dogs. We were being followed by the police all the time. You know, these things were a daily event in our lives. Even in, and I was going to school at that time, in rural Bloomington, Indiana, where you would think, why would there be any need to have people followed? I mean, we were being told that we were being followed by the FBI. And this was before the days of CARE. Thank God we have CARE now, because we didn't have anybody to go to then to say, hey, help us out. Although we did try to form little groups to respond to articles in the news and things like that, but they were just little groups with no power. What we saw was that the community itself was running parallel with its own racial and ethnocentric issues and a social microcosm. And it wasn't PC really to talk about that then. It's not really PC to talk about it now, but we need to talk about it. And what I started to see was that I had left a dominant culture that proposed, you know, white hegemony, which I wanted to get away from. And one of the things that I liked about Islam was that one person is not superior to another. But then I came into a community where it had its own structure, just like the dominant culture, where Arab was at the top of the pyramid, and then there were other gradations falling beneath it. This was problematic, and I got a real serious wake-up call to this when I decided to marry my husband. For those of you who don't know, my husband is African-American, and when I chose to marry him, all of my Arab friends that I had been friends with for, I was Muslim for about 2 years before I got married, they fled. They were upset with me because I did not choose to marry an Arab. I was supposed to marry an Arab. And my husband's mosque, where he went, the women were upset with him as well. And they wrote us a letter saying they were going to boycott any children we had and our marriage. So that was my entree to a bunch of African American sisters who I'd never met, who never seen me, who I still don't know. But you know, their issue that I came to understand was that they had a problem with a man who had a PhD marrying a white woman. And over time, actually, so one thing I should share is that I grew up in Indiana myself in an all-white town. So I did not have an awareness of the African American community. And as I gained this awareness, I also understood this issue. It allowed me to develop empathy and understand it. And those sisters, their actions, I eventually, even though they didn't seek my forgiveness, I forgave them, because then having children myself, I understood what it was like to have the context of what it means to be black in America. My biracial children, my multi-ethnic stepchildren have confronted many of these issues, and so I've got to see them firsthand. There are several silver linings to this, namely that I've been blessed to come in contact with a lot of different cultures and learn about them and raise my awareness. It all hasn't been discrimination and trauma. I have, you know, this year I earned an award, you know, as a global scholar for my impact on the world of psychology, and Monday is my 21st anniversary, so all those people who weren't in favor of that marriage, it actually worked out pretty well. And so all that is to say, just to finish, that our community needs to figure out why we see converts the way we do, and what we need to do as a collective conscience to deal with this issue. What can we do about it? Because our community is only as strong as its weakest member. And so we really need to have more dialogue and think about this and share our stories, because I'm sure all of us have something that will connect with the other. Thank you.